is I haven't worn socks just because I'm rebelling that it's spring and I should not have to wear socks and my feet are freezing.
Right, I know. I kind of do that, not that, but like I'll underdress on top. I won't wear a coat. I'm not wearing a coat.
Right.
I'm not wearing gloves and a hat.
I'm wearing a leather jacket no matter what, but I really needed a heavier coat.
I do see some people here in Michigan Avenue walking up and down, and they've got hat, gloves, scarves, their heads down. It's like, okay, you're ridiculous. Stop it.
Yeah, that's
it.
A little much.
I know it's cold, but have some dignity, man.
Put your North Face away.
I know. Well, even like some of the North Face jackets aren't completely, but some of these people, they look like they're like at level 2 on Mount Everest, you know, base camp 4.
Well, they're probably from Florida and thinking that May is a wonderful time to visit Chicago.
I do feel bad for the people that come to this fair city, particularly since I'm down here on weekends. And I know that some of these people, this is the big day for them, Saturday and Sunday. And you know, some of these weekend days have just been miserable lately. That you run into when you travel anywhere. You know, we went on a Danube River cruise with a bunch of listeners last year, and it rained just about every single day.
You run the risk. I know this weekend in my hometown of Louisville, you know, is a Kentucky Derby, and it's going to be cold and rainy, and I just feel so bad because it's such a wonderful experience. If the weather's great, it's not such a great experience if the weather's bad.
All those hats are going to get
wet.
The
whole thing is just
a nightmare.
That
is one of the things, the Kentucky Derby, that when you watch on TV, you don't want, who watches horse racing on TV? Most folks don't even go to the track, but I love the whole pageantry of that thing.
It's the most exciting 2 minutes in sports.
And that's this weekend?
This Saturday, first Saturday in May.
I wouldn't even know that until maybe Thursday, normally. Thank you for tipping me off to that.
Well, there you go. No pun intended on the tip.
Yeah, exactly. And then when it comes on, I'm like, oh. And then suddenly I wish that I knew more about it. I'd like to say, boy, I hope that, you know, Birdo or whatever the name of the horse is, I hope that that one particular horse wins. I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know.
Me either. I'm waiting for my dad to give me my tips.
By the way, is there a horse named Birdo in the race?
You know what?
Year?
I haven't even looked this year because, unfortunately, I'm not going to be there. I'm going to be at the Cubs game. So I haven't paid that much attention, but I need to because my dad's going to want to know. Who do you want to bet? What's your horse?
It was a long joke with my dad. He'd love to do the announcer for us, you know, and he'd be the horse track announcer. And he would always say, and they're coming down the home stretch. It's Birdo on the rail. Here comes. We'll go, all right, Dad, we've heard that joke 1,000 times. The true tragedy is I'm now repeating it on the radio.
There you go. You are your father.
We're going to talk about nutrition one more time today, just because it came up yesterday that the Ag Department wants to change some of the guidelines for school lunches. And so we found a nutritionist who can answer some of the questions that sort of came up yesterday. Which milk is better or worse? I actually learned something surprising from her off the air today. She's going to join us at 1:35 and whole grains and things like that. So we'll talk about that in a little while. But in doing some research on that, I did find the story of the worst breads you can eat. You know, every bread in the bread aisle of the grocery store looks delicious. And it looks like they have your best interest at heart, even though you know some of those are the equivalent of donuts. They're just shaped differently. And the one bread, I'll just read you the description before I tell you which one it is. It said, who should get the award for worst bread? The bakers of this or the food scientists who came up with it, because this bread is a conglomerate of nearly 50 chemicals, additives and preservatives, sugar, liquid sugar, honey, and invert syrup all contribute to a high sugar content and their weight loss stifling ingredients. And there are weight loss stifling, I see. So in other words, good luck burning this stuff off. Weight loss stifling ingredients like mono and diglycerides, along with ingredients we typically would not find in bread. Calcium silicate, which is typically used as the ingredients that we would find in insulation material, and calcium stearate, the main components for soap scum, and monocalcium phosphate, which is commonly used in fertilizers. In fact, these ingredients are all GRAS, generally recognized as safe. The label for these bread ingredients are GRAS, generally recognized as safe by the FDA. But it is still unsettling that the same additives that we're eating are being used in these non-food applications. Fertilizer, insulation, soap. And I have just given you their description of the best food on earth. It's those King's Hawaiian honey dinner rolls. Oh my gosh. Do you know the ones I'm talking about? The Hawaiian rolls at the grocery store?
They're really super sweet.
Oh man, they are. They're sweet, but I don't think they're too sweet. It's not like a Danish. Oh, I think that's the best food.
It's like a Danish.
You get that and a little honey ham and maybe some Swiss cheese and a little of that brown mustard on there.
Some insulation. Don't forget the insulation.
You don't have to put a tomato on this thing. I wouldn't run if you put a pickle on there, though. Maybe even just a little shaved red onion. And then you put that sweet Hawaiian king's bread dome on the top. Oh, man. I want to applaud the scientists. They say scientists as though that's a pejorative, as though scientist is a bad thing. You know, you imagine these people with beakers in a laboratory. And now we'll put in the sodium silicate. Well, put it in if it tastes good. Well, all I know is that thing comes out of an oven. I think it may come out of a mold at an industrial warehouse in New Jersey. But however it is, they craft these things. Oh, my God, is that a good food? I'm exhausted. King's Hawaiian, they say, should get a trophy for the worst bread. I don't know if that... They're not a sponsor, are they? I hope they are, because I can sell this stuff. It's a good food. It's just really not very good for you. Perhaps our standards are so harsh, so severe, so particular for our health in this country that which we would describe as the worst food is in fact a sort of thing that the rest of the world would say, oh, thank you, may I have another? And they would be better for it.
That's crazy talk.
I mean, I don't think it is.
Well, I mean, it depends on where you're going. If you're going to an impoverished area.
Well, for instance.
Okay.
Well, you know.
Do you go to Europe? I go to Europe. I was just thinking of this the other day. I'm coming home to the food I eat.
Yeah.
It's remarkable the food that you can get at a truck stop in Ireland, you know, or France or wherever.
Yeah.
Fresh bread, crusty bread. You know, real ingredients, and we don't eat the food we eat here. It's great. It's mass-produced. It's cheap, but it's not as quality as you get there.
Probably right.
Probably.
By the way, Jim's on the line. Is this Jim on line one? Hey, Jim, this is John Williams, and you're on WGN. What did you want to say, sir?
Hey, John. Just going back to the Derby.
Yeah.
Last year, we found out that my wife's, I believe it was her great-uncle, won the Derby in 1913 on a horse called Donnerail, and they still hold the track record for, or the world record for, the highest odds ever paid out.
Really? Donnerail wasn't supposed to win that day, huh?
No.
Huh.
He also was responsible for jockeys wearing helmets.
Oh, really? How come? Did he have a fall or something?
His brother passed from a fall.
Yeah. Well, when you read Seabiscuit, you know, she Laura Hillebrand does a great job. Laura Hillebrand, right, Steve? Seabiscuit?
Yeah.
Does a great job of telling the history of horse racing and how fantastically dangerous it has been and really still is. I mean, you think about it. You got guys that weigh maybe 90 pounds on a 2-ton horse doing 35 miles an hour in traffic. I mean, it's pretty crazy.
And they don't wear pads on their hoofs.
On their hoofs? The horses don't?
Yeah, there's no padding on the hoofs, so if you fall off.
Yeah, right.
Good luck.
Yeah, see, you were telling a joke, and I didn't even get it there, Jim. By the way, I'm just Googling.
Well, you know, one Saluki to another.
Oh, no kidding. Carbondale boy. So what if I type in 1913... Kentucky Derby, did you say that?
Correct.
Derby winner.
I never remember his true name. He's known as Goose.
Yeah, Roscoe Goose lived the dream of every Kentucky-born jockey, and he did it riding the most unlikely horse. The odds were 91-1. Goose rode Donnerail to victory in the 1913 Derby. Remains the longest shot ever to win. A $2 bet on him returned $185 in a 1913. I'll bet that was some dough, huh?
I imagine he passed as a millionaire, so he raised and trained horses at Arlington for years afterwards.
How about that? What a great story. Hey, Jim, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate you dialing in.
I will talk to you soon. I'm going to send you a picture of my Converse from 1964.
Okay, well, we could do that. You're going to send me pictures of your high-top Chuck Taylor Converse?
Converse All-Stars that I played in 1964. My mother brought them to me for some reason.
I'm going to hang up now, Jim, but I want you to do that and stay in touch, okay?
Will do. Thanks, John.
You get all the good stuff.
I was actually cleaning out a closet yesterday, just digging through some shoes, and I found my red. I have a collection, or did. I haven't kept it up, and so I've thinned it out over the years, but of Chuck Taylor Converse, and I think he was picking up on that. In fact, once upon a time, I got Dave Stewart, legendary newsman here, and Max Field, legendary traffic reporter here. Me, I think producer Matt Bubala, maybe Dave Kaplan, legendary sports guy here. And I got us all high-top Chuck Taylor Converse with our names and 720 WGN stitched in the side. You can go on a site and have your Converse customized. And I still have my red pair, and it's still fun to wear those things. Andrew Jackson was the... You want to do some Andrew Jackson trivia, Steve? I believe he was the seventh president of the United States.
Yeah, you know, I had a grandmother who insisted I was related to Andrew Jackson.
See, now I don't know you well enough to know if you're kidding
me.
No,
I did. I don't know if it's true, but that was the lore.
You going to go with them?
Yeah.
Now, if you could switch, I'd switch over to somebody. Actually, this is the thing. You know, John Meacham, the author who wrote... Did you interview John Meacham?
Yes. His last book was on George Bush.
And he's written... Oh, no kidding, really, yeah. Because he's written... What was it? The Colonials? He's written about our founding fathers, and he obviously wrote about Andrew Jackson famously. He's best maybe known for that book. And so we reached out to his people today. He can't join us today to give us our little primer on Andrew Jackson. But he wrote an open letter to President Bush, to President Trump, John Meacham did, saying if you're going to sort of adopt as your meme, as your guy, Andrew Jackson, here's something you should know. And you might imagine that the biographer of Andrew Jackson would say some good things about him. If you devote that much of your life to him, you see the person more three-dimensionally, I think, than the rest of us do. So good for him, and hopefully, the president read it. But on another side, I found just some other fun Andrew Jackson facts. And one of them, Steve, okay, this is top 10 things you didn't know about Andrew Jackson. One of these I don't think even can be true. I'll get to that in a minute.
As the seventh president of the United States, when he fought to defend the forgotten men and women from the arrogant elite of his day. Does it sound familiar?
It's President Trump, obviously, speaking about the president that for the strangest reasons he's decided to sort of talk about and adopt. I guess maybe we all put that out there first. We said, well, President Trump most reminds us of President Jackson. Now he's paying attention. And rather than saying nothing or no, he's saying, yeah, sure. And he's finding good things to say about him. On the 250th anniversary of Andrew Jackson's birth or death, there he was in Tennessee, speaking at his old estate about what a great president he was. And I don't think that's the time or place to dismiss the president. That's when you say good things about the president if you're going to go to his thing and do the thing in Tennessee. So that's fine. But you don't have to do that at all. I mean, of all of the presidents, that might be the one that might give you pause. But if you're Donald Trump and they say you remind us of this guy for not good reasons, by the way, he's the kind of guy that jumps in, adopts it, makes it his own, doubles down. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But then, if you go to 10 things you didn't know about Andrew Jackson, here are two that are kind of fantastic. Jackson had a ferocious temper. He killed a man in a duel in 1806 for insulting his wife, Rachel, who died shortly before Jackson took over control of the country. Imagine us today electing a guy who previously shot a man to death because that guy insulted his wife. Actually, I think maybe the sort of attitude in this country is that would look good on your resume. It sure did. It sure didn't keep Andrew Jackson from getting elected. But here's the one, Steve, that I don't know if I should believe or not. Jackson's pet parrot attended his funeral in 1845, but had to be removed after he used foul language. They had to take the parrot out because right. It was cussing a blue streak.
I've heard that before.
I don't think that's... that sounds apocryphal to me. What's your estimated probability that that's true?
That the parrot attended the funeral, I would say 98%.
And that he cussed so much they had to have the parrot removed.
That, I'm going to, well, who, did Meacham say it?
I didn't read it in his book. I read it on a website that said 10 things you need to know about Andrew Jackson.
Well, if we need to know it, it must be true.
Must be true, yeah. Shame on me for even asking. It's 129. The news is coming up. Oh, and then, by the way, after the news, so we found a really delightful nutritionist. Okay, forget about the kids' school lunches, although we'll hang this conversation on that. But what kind of milk should you drink? Whole grains, are they really that much better? Is this King's Hawaiian bread that bad? And sodium, how about that? They actually are going to maybe roll back what were going to be more severe sodium restrictions for kids. So you and your kids, what you should and shouldn't eat, coming up. This is John Williams. It's 139. Nancy Lambert is a registered dietitian at Portrait Health Center. She and I talked off the air today, and I was learning so much. I said, Nancy, come on the radio and talk to us a little bit. She's a registered dietitian, and I asked her to answer a couple questions that came up on yesterday's show about the food we eat. Hi, Nancy. It's John. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you know why I called? It was because the ag secretary said, well, we should maybe reconsider some of the dietary guidelines for school lunches. In general, they said we maybe don't have to be so sodium restricted. We don't have to force grain breads on the kids, and we don't need to give them the thinnest of milks. In general, what would you say about all of that?
Well, it's a little unfortunate from a dietary standpoint. I think we were probably making some headway of getting the kids introduced to something that might take them into the future and with a little more health. So to me, it's a little unfortunate. The changes that they're making, we get used to a certain amount of sodium as you know, our palates get used to a certain amount, and to decrease that just helps. It'll take time. A whole grain, we've got sort of gotten away from whole grains, and it really needs to be at least half of the grains served to a child in a day. And the milk, we do need fats, but I think that is something that the kids probably don't really even recognize as they're from one milk to the next. They may not even.
Well, I've heard mixed reviews on that. I've talked to some parents and they say that the taste of whole milk, or maybe 2%, is so much better texture and taste than 1% or skim milk. I guess everybody has a different answer to that. And the idea was, if you want the kids to drink the milk, and you do, then give them the milk that's more flavorful. So give them whole milk. Better that they drink that than they throw away the skim. I mean, that's sort of a quandary for all of us, isn't it?
It is, and I think that it's a matter of, as you know, as a whole, all of us should really be trying to decrease some of that saturated fat in our diet. Saturated fat's always going to come from an animal. So if a child doesn't care for skim milk or 1%, what you could possibly do is maybe mix a whole milk with a 2%, and eventually you'll get used to that, and you can, you know, gradually take it down to a lower, you know, fatted milk. I don't think it needs to be skim. I think that 1% or 2% would be appropriate. Children do need.
What about the rest of us?
In their diet.
What about the rest of you?
Well, the rest of you, I think that, as you said, it is important that children do drink milk. So getting them to drink it is important. The rest of us, 1% is probably a good compromise, I think. 1%, 2%.
But how much percent? Well, what's the percentage in whole milk? I mean, that's not 50% fat, right? It's probably.
Oh, it's usually about 3.3% fat.
Well, here's my theory on that, Nancy. Thanks for asking. It goes like this. When you consider all the things that we're eating and drinking, if the worst of it is milk with a little too much fat, good Lord, better that than a diet soda or beer or wine or something, right? So.
Totally agreed.
We could
totally
do worse.
Totally agree with you.
You know what I've also noticed? You started talking about sodium a minute ago and how we get acclimated one way or another. Maybe we generate a taste for it, but we could also acclimate ourselves in a more positive direction. Does some of that happen with age? I have found that now that I'm over 23, that salt bothers me a lot more. Like one of my favorite pizzas in Chicago, I really can't eat. Every time I eat it now, I don't know if I'm tasting salt, but I'm feeling and tasting something. And I know it's sodium. And I can't enjoy it anymore. I wonder if that happens to everyone as they age.
Well, I don't know if it's age. I think it's how much you've eaten, probably how much you were introduced to as a child. And as you go through your life, I'm not sure it has anything to do with age, but it's possible that you might have been noticing that you were and choosing foods that were a little lower in sodium, and therefore your palate for it changes. And then when you go to something that has a higher sodium content, you can spot it right away.
Well,
and it just is way too much.
I guess maybe that's it. I mean, my wife is very sodium conscious when she cooks, and mostly I eat Brenda's food. Aurelio's, if you're listening, if you could come up with a low sodium pizza, and I suppose it's in the sauce, huh?
Possibly.
Please, I miss your pizza, man, but I just don't enjoy it anymore. John had a question for you. John, you're on the air. You're on WGN. Hi.
Well, I think we really need to go back to the source of these farmers putting in all kinds of chemicals into the cows to, you know, make them produce more, make them grow faster. So I think that's really more important than what percentage of fat is in the milk.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you think about that, Nancy?
Well, it is a possibility. I would agree with that. I try and buy organically grown or locally sourced whenever I can. For school systems, I think it's a little more difficult. But I think in general, if I try and incorporate those more holistic items into my diet as well.
John, thanks for the call. This is Mike. You're on WGN. What was your question or comment, Mike?
Hi, yeah. I was just going to ask if kids these days are actually being indoctrinated into looking for and consuming organic foods and drinks. And Nancy, I got a question. Years ago, I heard that, I don't know if this is just a rumor or so many myths about nutrition, it's astounding. I heard that beer actually helps to prevent kidney stones. Is that correct?
I actually don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that question.
I'm going to believe that that's true, Mike. That may be wishful.
Both of us would love to believe that. I think that, you know, it's back to a lot of things in moderation, everything in moderation, and with common sense. That has to have a little common sense behind that. I think that if we drink too much beer, that probably won't be a good thing either.
Well, the pendulum goes back and forth on a lot of foods, coffee, chocolate, wine.
It does.
Milk, maybe. It seemed to me like I thought that the pendulum was going back towards higher fat content in milk wasn't such a bad thing. It's 146. You've got a question, too? The number's 312-981-7200. Nancy Lambert's on the line. She's a registered dietitian at Portrait Health Centers. This is WGN. Nancy Lambert's on a phone line. She is a registered dietitian at Portrait Health Centers there throughout the metro. She's just talking to us a little bit about the food the kids eat, and then we all start asking about the foods that we eat. Nancy, will you take a couple more questions from listeners with us?
I'd love to.
Harold, you're on WGN. What's your question or comment? Hi.
Thank you, John. Hello, Nancy. How are you?
Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I've seen somewhere on in the Internet, and we all know they tell the truth constantly.
They do.
I saw something that talked about that the milk in general these days has a higher content of estrogen than what a cow would normally have in the past, because it says that they provide estrogen to the cow to cause it to provide milk year round instead of just seasonally.
So what's your question about that, Harold? You just want to know if that's true?
Well, I want to know if that's true, and they say that organic milk would have a lower content of estrogen.
Okay, give us some guidelines on that, Nancy.
Oh, I wish I was a dairy farmer. I don't actually know the answer to that question. I really don't know if they're if one versus the other has more estrogen or not.
I'm going to go from.
I wish I had the answer to that.
Harold, that's another question for us another day. Thanks for calling. I'm sorry I couldn't help you.
But here's what I would like to add to that. If you're looking for sources on the Internet, I would encourage people to go to major universities or major health centers. For example, Harvard Public Health has a site, Mayo Clinic has a site, the University of Illinois, University of Wisconsin. Those are the National Institute of Health. Those are the places that you're going to get real information, current information, rather than an advocacy group of some sort. Yeah. So that's my comment there.
And one last milk question. That's Mike. You're on the air. Mike, what can we do for you? Hi.
Yeah, I keep on hearing things about that people shouldn't drink cow's milk at all, and that almond milk or soy milk is better for you, and plus they fortify it with calcium. So
I've never tried that almond milk, and I know, Lord knows, they've been trying to get me to try it. Have you tried that stuff, Mike?
I have it every day with cereal.
And how does that taste? How does it feel?
It's not as good as 2% milk, meaning it's a little thicker.
Yeah.
But you can get used to it. I'm starting to get used to it. But I've heard people say cow's milk was never intended for people to drink. It's meant for cows to drink.
Yeah. What do you say about all that, Nancy?
Well, I've heard that theory out there as well. Milk does supply what the almond milk does not supply, which is actually technically, I know it's not really milk, but it doesn't supply a lot of protein. If you'll compare the labels between different forms of milk, any nut milk or soy milk, rice milk, they don't supply as the quantity of protein that a cow's milk would serve. I think, you know, in general, the guidelines are still three servings in general for most of us of a dairy product is acceptable. So that's in a serving of a glass is not a 12-ounce glass of milk. It's a cup of milk is one of those servings. Ounce and a half of cheese or, something comparable, carton of yogurt. You've pretty much had your milk consumption for the day.
And I kind of wonder if it's more expensive.
Yeah, it probably is, yeah. Interesting. All right, I'm out of time. Nancy, I appreciate your time. We're going to call you again. And lots of questions, lots of comments. I hope you can join us down the road.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Nancy Lambert. And she is a registered dietitian. She is with, what was the name of her group over there again? Portrait Health Centers. By the way, every dairy farmer in the Midwest is called in now. David says he knows the difference between one and the other. Hey, David, this is John. You're on the air.
Hey, John. I'm not a dairy farmer. I've worked with a lot of them. They adhere to so many standards now in the purity of the milk that you deliver. The only difference between organic milk and the milk that you would normally buy in general is the label, to the point where if a cow is given medication when it's sick, they make the farmers dump out all of that milk until every last drop of medicine has left that cow's body. So it's really the label and the ability to pay for more milk. But side by side, you normally couldn't tell the difference in a lab test between organic milk and normal milk.
The only reason I get into that, and I don't much, is I think about the life of the animal. So when I see free-range chicken, I imagine chickens running around a yard, playing soccer, talking on their cell phones, having free time, and that these are the chickens I want to eat. I don't even know if that's true. I don't know if a free-range chicken has a superior life than one that's been factory-produced, you know?
Cows they're interesting animals. They like to be next to each other. They like to be second fine, but if you put them out in the field, they get next to each other.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
David, I appreciate you. Yeah, go ahead.
The almond milk, the amount of energy that it takes to produce almond milk and what it does to the environment is something that people kind of oversee, because you milk a cow, but to get an almond tree, you got machinery and gas and oil and pollution that's going into the air. So, again, to drink that almond milk, you might be thinking you're doing better for your body, but you're actually doing worse for the environment.
Wow. Got complicated, David.
I know.
Thanks for the call. Don't call here anymore. I don't want to hear from you. You're way too intelligent.
I promise. It's the first time I've ever been called smart. Thank you.
Remember when you used to have to decide cloth or plastic for the diapers for the kids, and you didn't know which was the more environmentally sound choice? Paper or plastic used to give us all pause. We said, oh, gee, if I go with paper, that's That's a paper mill. That's bad. It might biodegrade more easily, but paper mills consume a lot of energy, a lot of water, put off a lot of pollution. So I'll go with plastic, except the you see the bags blown across the highway and you feel terrible about that. I've been getting hit up with that 7-cent thing too, Steve. Do you ever find yourself paying the 7 cents for the bags?
That's
still
in the city, so I'm not shopping a lot.
Oh, you're not shopping in the city?
No.
But if you go over to the Walgreens over here.
Yeah.
7 cents for that bag.
Mm-hmm.
Was it you that was telling me the percentage by which the plastic bag use has gone down in the city as a result of that tax?
I hope it was, but I don't remember it.
It's like 40%
wow.
or something.
Well,
it was.
So that works.
Well, if I'm correct, my estimated probability on that is in the mid-40s, but I don't think I'm off. I think it was like 40-some percent that the use of plastic bags in the city of Chicago has gone down.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
I wonder why they keep talking about Trump and Jackson and Trump.
Here's John Williams.
There we go. 210. I began the show saying I wish it was a sports station.
Lord have mercy.
You know, because you just sit there and you go, oh, we got to get Schwarber to hit to the left side. What are we going to do with Dwayne Wade's contract? I don't have $25 million. Come here, call. That's my impersonation of a sports show. I wouldn't be any good at that either. But the thing is, now you got to learn about all kinds of things anymore. It used to be just enough to do something. Now you got to learn about Andrew Jackson. Most of us don't know about Andrew Jackson. If I said Old Hickory, you might get that. And if I said that he was a slave owner, you might get that. That he was hostile, you knew about his temper, maybe. You knew that he was unpopular for some of the things he said and did. And that he was a nationalist. The Wall Street Journal has an editorial today that says we have to stop considering nationalist as a bad word or term. And I thought that's enlightened. I mean, maybe we should, but I think we should also then ask the people who are using it to not be lousy. But that's a different subject. So here we are now trying to figure out who Andrew Jackson is, if the president has adopted that as sort of his mentor, right? And so on a phone line is a professor. Julian Zelzer joins us. Julian is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. I won't take much of your time, professor, but I just had a couple questions about we should or should not know about Andrew Jackson. How are you this afternoon?
How are you? Nice to speak to you.
What's the first thing you would say?
Well, he was a sort of conservative populist, meaning he did appeal to white working and middle class Americans. He was present when suffrage was expanding. He was also a slave owner. He was also very harsh with Native Americans. And those were two sides of the same president. I would add he passed away long before the Civil War started, which is connected, obviously, to President Trump's recent remarks.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder just as a bit of advice from somebody who knows both of them better than I do, I wonder how much baggage you sort of adopt when you say, yeah, I'm going to endorse Jacksonianism. I'm going to be an Andrew Jackson type president. Is that a good choice?
There's a lot of baggage to it. Some people have used Andrew Jackson to point to a strong leader. They've used him to talk about a president who did appeal to the quote-unquote common man, but that comes with all the baggage. Again, the slaveholding, it also comes with the baggage of the Native American policy, and all of that is connected to him. And
well,
so even when President Trump says he could have solved the civil crisis before a civil war took place, it's unclear how he imagines he would have solved that and what that would have meant for American society because of all that baggage.
Yeah, obviously, the president has said some things that just the tenses of his verbs don't always match the subjects. He's run into that too many times. And rather than dwell on that, I thought, okay, well, he's going to embrace Jackson, so let's learn a little bit about him. He wasn't that educated, right? I mean, he eventually became an attorney, but he did not have an easy upbringing. He was a self-made man, right?
Right. And this was part of his appeal. This was part of what he sold as the leader of the country. And it's really an important part of how he has been remembered and certainly used by President Trump as a comparison to who he says he is, President Trump. So this is not someone who came from an elite background. It was not someone with much political experience. His experience was primarily in the military.
Well, So this is one piece from John Meacham's open letter to Donald Trump in the Tennessean. I think it was reprinted widely. I think I also saw it in USA Today. But it's his open letter to the president saying that if you're going to be like Jackson, here's a few things that you should know. And Meacham obviously wrote the book about Andrew Jackson. And this is one thing he said that I thought was just really smart. He said, "Mr. President, there is an anxiety that you are too enamored of your own political base, that all of your tweets and all of your energy are directed toward motivating only those who already agree with you." Comment on that, Professor.
Well, that's true. This is a president people keep asking, when will President Trump broaden his appeal and when will he reach out not only to Democrats but to non-base Republicans? And so far he's not, and I think it's fair to say that his focus has been on people who support him. The way he speaks, the policies he pushes have often been targeted toward that base. And I think this is the strategy of the campaign and now of the president, meaning shore up the people who support you passionately, depend on Republicans ultimately being partisan and loyal to the party, and that's enough to win. And President Jackson has always symbolically been an important figure for that base. He's been a figure
right
in a lot of the electorate right who is part of that conservative populist argument.
But this notion that you're a populist, I'm not sure that I understand that word then, because I get that we're going to drain the swamp and we use elite as a pejorative and we're going to be for the common people, right? But then when you become the president and you still dismiss half the country, you don't seem to really, in fact, be interested in the larger population, maybe because they're rich or because they're educated or because they're not like you. But I don't sense from Jackson, and I sure don't sense from Trump, that they are, in fact, interested in the larger percentage of the population.
Well, that's a fair criticism, and there's another side of that criticism that some observers have, and that he's not that concerned either with the base of support he keeps talking about when it comes to policy, that he hasn't done much for them either. So conservative populism so far has been more rhetorical, and we don't really know what it means in practice. Look, many look at the tax cut he at least proposed on paper and say that's not really going to resonate in the pockets of the electorate that are hurting economically and that voted for him,
yeah,
even though they voted Democratic. So now populism is just a rhetorical appeal to the quote-unquote forgotten American and to middle-class Americans who are struggling. But in policy, we don't really know what that's going to mean.
Yeah, and that's the danger of it too, isn't it? If you fall in love with this politician because you believe the image they represent, if, in fact, their deeds don't follow through on that, you're going to be sorry. You're screwed again. The guy that you put in place to help you out is, in fact, not going to help you with taxes, and his health care plan might not be any better.
And many Republicans are aware of this. And he should remember, I mean, President Trump should remember that some of the voters in those parts of the electorate who were key to his victory voted for President Obama 4 years earlier. So they are not totally, wholly loyal voters. And so his record will be examined in a few years. And if his policies don't match up to what he has been talking about, this can be a problem.
Well, did Jackson get reelected?
Yeah, but let me just add, I'm sorry, one other thing. Part of the appeal isn't just economic, and we have to remember that. So part of the appeal, both of evoking Jackson, who's reelected, is the nativism, is the kind of racism. It's not an appeal just to economic issues. It's appeal to anger and hatred. And I think in many ways the current administration is counting on that and is counting on that in evoking the Jackson presidency.
I'm sorry, you just said that it's an appeal to anger and racism.
Part of Donald Trump's appeal in the campaign, that populism, hasn't simply been, I will give you economic policies A, B, and C. It was also using questions of immigration. It was using questions of race as another way to appeal to those very same voters. And so this has always been part of President Trump's message.
And I guess that was Jackson too, huh? Is that so?
Maybe
it's an end unto itself then. That is, Maybe these people don't care. I mean, this my friend Steve Bertrand and I have this conversation now and again, and I think I end up saying, I don't know that they even care if their taxes go up or down. They want Donald Trump.
Well, I think that's a rational way to look at it, and it's a question about this electorate. And so when people say, as I just did, that if he doesn't deliver economically, they might not vote for him, might be that's not in the end what motivates them the most. It might be him, or it might be these other aspects of his appeal.
I don't know that Donald Trump studied Andrew Jackson that much. I think he, like the rest of us, is getting a fast read on the guy. But when he famously said, I could walk down Fifth Avenue, shoot somebody, and those people would still support me. In fact, Andrew Jackson did. In fact, he did murder the guy who insulted his wife and became president twice.
Well, I think that's part of the reaction to when he makes a statement like he did about the Civil War. He is someone, President Trump, who plays fast and loose with the facts, historical and otherwise, all the time. And so not a lot of people are giving him the benefit of the doubt that he seriously thought about how this nation could have avoided or whether it could have avoided the war that tore us apart. I think most people conclude this is just him hearing a couple things from an advisor and then repeating them on air. And he does this so many times that it's hard for him to get, you know, a serious conversation going about any idea that he has of this sort.
Well, you don't get the sense if you listen to his speech at the Hermitage, how do you pronounce that in Tennessee?
Yes, Hermitage, yes.
That he wrote that speech. I mean, he had libs around his speeches. He did that in Pennsylvania on his 100th anniversary. So you get a sense of the man, but clearly when there are rhetorical flourishes, that's not his pen. It's 2:20. Professor, it's nice to talk to you. I appreciate your time this afternoon. I'll call you again. It's nice to meet you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Julian Zellner is on a phone line. He is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. I understand that another president, Steve, has called into our little radio show here. You'll never, ever guess who it is. Did you pick up a phone? President Jefferson, are you there?
I am.
Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
We're live on WGN Radio. You just heard that, Professor, sir. I appreciate your calling in. I guess you heard some of that, huh?
Interesting. You know, Princeton was the College of New Jersey in my time, and my closest friend, James Madison, attended Princeton. That's where he became the great constitutionalist that he became.
Do you agree with much of what that man just said?
Yes, I knew Andrew Jackson. Not well. He visited me at Poplar Forest in 1815. He was just coming off his surprise victory at New Orleans in the War of 1812. I didn't greatly admire him. He seemed like a vulgarian to me. He had a very shadowy capacity with the English language. As you said, he was a duelist. I think he was in 5 affairs of honor in the course of his life.
Really?
Yeah, 5 affairs. Not all of them led to duels, but he was one, like Hamilton, he was one of those prickly people who's always defending honor. You know, what happened was that he married a woman who technically, and unknown to him, was still married to a previous husband.
So that'll happen.
This became a very serious issue in his life, and he had to defend Rachel, his wife, against those who used that as a way of scandalmongering against him and his policies.
Well, I still got to believe, though, that when you pull the trigger in one of those things and the guy falls, you're like, oh, crap, what did I do? Did they really want to murder the other guy?
Well, some do, some don't. I think that Andrew Jackson is a bloodthirsty man. When he came to Poplar Forest to dine with me, I had him for supper, and then he had me into town for another supper. I was somewhat embarrassed to be in his presence. It felt like he still had blood on his hands. And then when he won the election of 1828, which was the first great populist victory in American history, his inaugural on March 4th, 1829, was a disaster. People pulled the drapes down in the White House. They stood on the couches. They broke windows and tracked mud in. They stole souvenirs. It was a sort of low-level inaugural riot. So he brought a kind of buffoonery and vulgarity to the office of president that had not been seen before. I mean, think of it. Washington, 2 terms. Adams, 1. I had 2 terms. Madison, 2. Monroe, 2. And John Quincy Adams, one of the greatest secretaries of state, had a term, and then suddenly here's this this populist from the West who makes a virtue out of not knowing much.
Well, I'm out of time today, sir. I just wanted to kind of get your reaction to that conversation and any wisdom that you had for us about Andrew Jackson today.
Oh, thank you. Let me say this much. The populism is not a bad thing. What Andrew Jackson represented was a resonance with the aspirations of the great common people of this country. I'm in favor of that. He might have been able to prevent the Civil War. He was a fervent nationalist and was not going to put up with the nullification nonsense of John Calhoun in South Carolina. So he didn't live enough long enough to see that crisis, but he might have been able to prevent that great war.
We'll talk again, sir. You and I will have a stage in the Chicago area in December of this year.
Thank you, sir.
President Jefferson joining us on a phone. It's 2:24. I think if you told your kid you could learn Spanish, Chinese, or coding, and you were only worried about their ability to make a living, I would teach them coding. I wish I knew computer coding. My nephew was showing me how to do it. He was literally just showing me some of the things, and it looks like Chinese. You hit a dot and then a space and then a this and then a that. And then you do all of those, and you got to get it exactly right. And if you do, then it just means the smidgenest of a thing on a screen. Then you got to do it over and over again. You know, the image of a bunch of kids sitting around Griff and I watched Silicon Valley last night. What a great show. What a great, funny, hilarious, tapped-in show that is. But the idea of somebody just sitting there all day long for weeks on end with headphones, typing away code, seems to be true. Four Eyes thinks taking care of your eyes should not cost you an arm and a leg. That's why when you buy one pair of glasses, Four Eyes gives you a second pair for free. It's just one way Four Eyes saves you money, and you can mix and match great brands like Gucci, Hugo Boss, Kate Spade, Nike, Coach, Marc Jacobs, and more. My goodness, there's a list that goes on here. Stella McCartney, Burberry. Visit foureyes.com to schedule an eye exam and find your nearest location. That's foreyes.com. Foreyes.com. I don't have time to get into this. We'll talk maybe more about it tomorrow. But it's in the USA Today today. Dateline San Francisco. Facebook admits it did not follow its own policies when it showed at least one advertiser how to reach emotionally insecure and vulnerable teens. But it says Facebook does offer tools to target advertising to users based on their emotional state. Facebook not only knows who you are, they know how you're feeling, and they target advertisers to you based on your emotions.
You didn't think those emojis were for your friends, did you?
Of course. Oh, gosh, that's how they would know. Sad face, exclamation mm-hmm. point.
That's why I always emojify counter to my actual feelings.
I do not emojify. My wife has recently discovered emoji.
It's sad, isn't it? When one of them goes over?
I'm losing her. I didn't. And you know, when we began dating in the 1980s, I could not have known, 1970s, no. I couldn't have known that she was going to be an emoji user, what with, you know, electricity not having been invented
and
yet. No.
Had they been around, I wouldn't have, you know, put her in the emoji camp.
I would not either.
Something
I know.
Something happens.
It's startling. I'm like, who are you, woman?
Starts with a smiley face.
No, and then the smiley face I give you. Okay, smiley face, everybody gets the smiley face. That was a bumper sticker in the 60s, for crying out loud. You get to have that. But then you get a couple thumbs up, don't you? And you get that little Martian in the TV screen. I don't even know what that one means yet. And then you get a little...
Then you get whole sentences from pictures.
I know. And I'm like, really? Were you hit by a rock? Have you lost the ability to communicate? I'm done now. It's 2:30. The news is next. You know how yesterday we were talking about the fact that this is the 10-year anniversary of one of the weirdest weeks in Will County. And I was talking to Amy Jacobson off the air because she was one of the people reporting on the Lisa Stebbick disappearance, presumably death. Craig Stebbick and all of that was going on 10 years ago. Yesterday was the day that she was reported missing. And so I called over to Amy and said, hey, jump on here for a second with us. You couldn't join us yesterday for scheduling reasons, but you said you had a few minutes today. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Good, John Williams. Good to hear you back on the radio on WGN.
Last I saw you, I think we were at Donna Long's, our one-time receptionist here, sort of induction into some Southside Hall of Fame. Do you remember that night?
Oh, my gosh, that was so long ago, but I do remember it. That was. Do you still look the same, John?
I do. I presume you do, too. Kathy and Judy were with us that night. They still do. I haven't seen Donna in the longest time, but that was a funny and strange night. Now you are the co-host of Chicago's Morning Answer on WIND with Dan and Amy. 10 years ago, what were you doing?
Well, I was on my way to East Bank Club, and I got an invite to go to Craig Stebbick's house because I was trying to get him to go on camera because it had been such a long time. So I always remained, you know, had an open line of communication between him and myself, and his sister was visiting from Iowa, and she was at his house with her three kids, who are the same age as my two boys. So I decided, you know what, I want to secure my source. You know, I trust them. They're, you know, she's a lovely woman, and we went over there, and we... You know, we didn't, there was no pool party. It was just, you know, getting to know your sources a little bit better.
No.
And I wasn't swimming with Craig Stebbick. I mean, that, we weren't even in the water at the same time. That whole thing was just hyperbole and a gross exaggeration of the truth. But it sold papers and it got, you know, BBM TV a lot of hits on their website, like 3 million hits right away, immediately on their website.
No kidding. I was going to say 10 years ago, maybe we weren't counting hits, but they were then.
No, they were. Oh, yeah, because they touted about it, too. Oh, now I sound angry. I'm not angry.
Well, okay, but so,
you know,
let's back.
This is the most viewed story ever in our history of our website. Yes.
So the for those who are unacquainted with the story, and I know you and I don't have a lot of time here, but Lisa Stebbick was a nice mother of a couple of kids living in Plainfield. She was on a rocky relationship with her husband. The divorce papers were going to be served, and suddenly she went missing. He reported her missing, right?
No, he didn't report her missing. Her friends, when she didn't show up for work the next day,
she
worked at the school's cafeteria. Well, that's what piqued police's interest. You know, if your wife's missing, why aren't you calling us?
But didn't he call one of her friends and say, hey, have you seen Lisa, right?
Yeah, he did do that, and he did go to one of the vigils, you know, but he didn't go on any searches, and he just always thought that they, I'll never forget, after that whole thing aired on Channel 2, I spoke with him, and he said, oh my gosh, they really think that I killed her. And I said, yeah, they do, okay? So where is she? Did you kill her? And he said, no, I didn't, Amy, I'm telling you, I didn't. Because he would keep a log, because, you know, when people go through divorce, it's never easy. And the day that she went missing, he had received a petition for eviction, which means basically they were asking him to move out of the house.
Sure.
And I don't think that that sat well with him. I mean, who wants to be thrown out of their house? Nobody does, especially a house that they buy. You don't want to be with your kids too. So he would keep a list in the kitchen of all of her activities, when she would leave, when she would come home.
Wait a minute. Why was he doing that?
Oh, it's for custody. I mean, really, any divorce attorney would tell you to keep the tabs on what your spouse is doing. Especially if you're getting involved in custody.
Well, what about this, Amy? I try not to judge people's reactions because we all do, and I hesitate. I won't say I'm good at it, but whenever somebody's on camera and they say, oh, look, they're not acting like the grieving widow or widower, or they're not acting the way they should if their kid went missing, and then we say, ah, something's fishy there. I don't know how I would react if some tragedy befell me, so I hope you don't judge my facial expression on camera one night and judge my guilt or innocence. So you
don't
know, so
mad at your wife over those emojis, okay?
Having said all of that, Amy, he did not act the way you should or would if the mother of your children has suddenly disappeared. At least that's the way I felt.
At that stage. Well, I think this is what from being a reporter for 18 years, everybody processes grief differently.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, cries differently. Some people don't cry or they hold it in. And, I mean, he had moments, you know, there was one time that I was over there, you know, just talking to him, trying to get him to go on camera. Because he'd let me in the house and he'd let a few other reporters, but everybody else, he just, you know, he didn't trust them. And he was crying. He's like, I don't know where she is. This has been so long. I don't know what's going on. And that was the only time that I actually saw him, you know, cry.
Do you think that he did it?
I don't, you know, I was summoned before a grand jury and they asked me the same question. Do I think he did it? If I had any substantial evidence or any inkling, I would definitely, you know, I would have told the grand jury.
Well, I don't have any evidence either, but do you think, but do you, you know him better than most?
I think it's a possibility, but, you know, of course, everybody's already formed their opinion about it, but I was working with the same investigators who told me that Kevin Fox had killed Riley Fox. For so long, they almost brainwashed me. And because I brought to them this other eBay guy. I said, "Ooh, there's somebody who's crazy right now," and he ended up being the killer. And they poo-pooed me right away because I went to his house with Todd Roberts, photographer from NBC, and they poo-pooed us like, "This guy's crazy. He's on the roof. He's acting erratic." And he had just been released from jail. And guess what? His shoes were found in the river, too. But no, they said, "No, we've got our guy." So it gave me great pause when they told me that they think that he did it. And then they would plant, you know, they would, I thought, make up stories just to try to get him to break. Because one time they said that they found some blood in the back of his flatbed. Well, it turned out to be blood from a deer because he's a big hunter. So, but he heard that. And I think that they were using us to try and to break him to see if, you know, maybe now he'll come forward or maybe now something will happen.
You never felt uncomfortable either in the presence of Craig Stebbik because maybe he did take his wife's life, or you never felt uncomfortable because you thought journalistically this, I'm going to have some explaining to do here.
No, you know, if he was inappropriate to me ever tried anything inappropriate or tried to hit on me, I would never have gone over there. But he was always a gentleman. I mean, he was not, you know, he just seemed like somebody who was lost and confused and, you know, like, you better get an attorney. Better get a different attorney than your divorce
attorney. That's pretty amazing to me that you were having those kinds of conversations with him. I mean, you know, this isn't a TV show about.
I know, but I'm pretty open-minded and basically generally a friendly person. I mean, to me, it's, you know, I've met mass murderers. I've met child molesters just because of the line of work that I do. And I obviously, if I felt that he was going to hurt me or my children, I would never have gone over there.
And just one last question about that. This isn't why I called, but the fact that you go over there, I guess you had formed a good enough relationship with him just tracking the story that you were close enough to him that you would find yourself at his place wearing a bikini at his pool.
John, we call it a two-piece, John.
You had a swimsuit on.
I had a swimsuit on.
And I too bad for you, I guess, right, that the other TV station caught an image of that.
Nowadays, if that happened today, I'd be lauded and celebrated. Like, oh, look, she's working on her day off. And look at all the social media attention it garnered. And, oh, our ratings are going to be huge now. But back then, that was different times in journalism. You know, I mean, for 5 years, I beat myself up. Oh, I should have put on that shirt. Or that, you know, that T-shirt or the...
You think that would have changed?
I wouldn't have
Have changed your career if that day you had on a T-shirt instead of a two-piece?
Heck, yeah.
Do you think about that a lot? Have you thought about her and what happened a lot?
I think about Lisa Stebbik every single day of my life. And I'm a churchgoer now, and at church on Sundays, I pray for her. And I pray for her family because she's got great kids. I mean, I saw... You know, Zach's in the Marine Corps, and Lexi, they were 10 and 12 when she disappeared, so they're adults now. And she's going to be a nurse or studying to be a nurse. And I, as a mother of two kids, I mean, I can't imagine ever leaving this earth with that great of a responsibility and that great of a love. I mean, there's no greater love than the love that you have for your children.
Do you have, when's the last time you spoke to Craig, her husband?
Gosh, it must have been 5 years ago. I think, but he moved, and he still lives in the area. So he lives in Joliet.
Yeah.
And I know people try to get him to talk for the 10-year anniversary, and he decided not to.
Probably wise. So,
I don't know.
You think that somebody killed her?
Definitely.
So it would have been a coincidence then that at the time when their marriage was at its lowest, somebody else took her life.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm not laughing at this. It's not funny, but it's absurd, and it's hard to imagine, you know?
Yeah, I know. Have you ever been divorced? I'm sorry.
No, I have not.
Well, after these emojis, you will be. No, I'm kidding. But it's really the worst time because you're losing everything. Like, your whole world is rocked. Where are you going to live? Are you going to have health care? Who's going to get the kids? I mean, it's really... a rough time.
Well, there you are. I mean, not everybody that goes through divorce is a potential killer, but you are describing for me a mindset where you could understand how somebody at their lowest point snaps and does something that they would not otherwise do.
Oh, yeah. When you're grieving, you're scared, you do things out of character.
That's no excuse either, right?
I mean,
you still did it. You don't get to do that.
Right. and get away with it. I mean, I certainly don't have homicidal tendencies, and I don't think that you do either, but we don't, you know, everybody's have different breaking points.
Well, I'm glad you're up and on your feet, still working in the business, and on this sort of 10 years plus one day anniversary, joining us today. Anything else that maybe you want to pass along as we sort of look back on that strange story?
Well, one day I was going to thank Larry Wirt for firing me, because I would never know my children if I had not been fired. And I've had the greatest time being, I'm coaching their boys volleyball team, and I'm coaching girls volleyball and basketball at their Chicago public school, and I absolutely love it. So I try to think of the positive, and that's positive.
Talk to you again, Amy. It's nice to hear your voice. Thanks for joining us.
Blessings. Thanks, John.
Yeah, Amy Jacobson over at WIND. It's 2:51 on WGN. We'll pause here in a couple of minutes. Rose right around the corner. Speaking of anniversaries, I didn't realize today is the 6-year anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death. And the man who took him out, as Rose says, will be his guest. Boy, there's a story to tell. When you go back and tell the Amy Jacobson story and the Lisa and Craig Stebbick story, I actually don't remember. I remember the conversations we all had about the appropriateness of how close she got to the source and about the fact that she was wearing a 2-piece swimsuit at the time. I mean, this is history. This is 10 years ago this week in Chicago. And people still have very strong lines drawn around that conversation. And honestly, I don't even remember where I was on that at the time. You know, the idea is that if you're smart enough, clever enough, or even pretty enough, or some combination of those three things to win the confidence of the man that people think killed the woman, then yeah, you pursue that. And if he calls you while you're on your way with your kids and you've got your swimsuit on and says, hey, come on over, then you come on over. You're working the story. You don't run home and put on some other clothes. You just zip on over there. And it was nothing more than that. And if the other competing stations thought it looked differently than it was, this is the one train of thought, right? Well, too bad for them. But too bad for her, because it cost her a job at the time. And I suppose it's just as easy to make the more obvious case that, lady, you don't do that. You don't go over there with your kids. What, are you kidding me? And that was all the rage 10 years ago. Which is all really beside the point. The true tragedy, of course, is that the mother of those children is missing, presumed dead, and that it looks like, well, somebody got away with it. All right, Rose in the studio. That's coming up next on WGN. Okay, it's 2:59 on WGN. This is John Williams saying so long for today. Ro Khan is about to say hello for today.
Hello for today.
And that's such a better version of him than what we started with yesterday when the Andrew Jackson news was breaking.
Very different Ro Khan today.
And how often do you get to say the Andrew Jackson news was breaking?
You never get to say it.
Most of that news has been broke.
For the next at least 3 years and 9 months, there's going to be a lot of things we're going to say, when's the last time we did this?
So what's coming up on you? How about this Osama bin Laden shooter guy you got?
Yes. So we're going to talk to the guy who, this on the anniversary of the...
Yesterday
in America, May 1st in America, but May 2nd, where it actually happened. So we're going to split the difference and call today the anniversary. We're going to talk to the guy who was the actual person through the door who killed Osama bin Laden.
Wow. So that was then President Obama was at the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner then, right? Is that when that was going on?
I remember it started.
He was at something, and he was being cool, calm, and funny.
You wouldn't have known.
And
right?
You wouldn't have known that he, in the back of his mind, was going, oh, man, I hope our guys don't die, and I hope this thing works.
Right, right. Wow. Right. So and then he was on. Went back to that. That's where you have that scene.
Famous picture.
Picture of them watching.
That was that night.
Right. At, I would imagine, 10 or 11 o'clock at night Eastern time, because it was happening, you know, pre-dawn raid, as they always do.
Yeah.
And
who can forget that picture? The tension in that room, the feeling of it.
Who was where,
faces.
And, you know. And then you have the Trump version of that when we fired those Tomahawk missiles into Syria.
Right.
And you saw the very same, looked like the same room, all of them looking at a monitor that's off screen.
Yeah.
And
you
saw who the power players were and how they were positioned. Sean Spicer was in the room in the corner. Funny thing on that one was that Jared Kushner was sitting two seats down from the president.
Right.
I mean, God bless him, but really, I'm kind of surprised right. that he was in that position that day.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think a lot of people thought that about Bill Daley when they saw him in the room for the Bin Laden.
Mm-hmm. I'm not
raid,
sure who's
right?
supposed to be in that room,
know.
So I don't know how. Maybe,
I don't know
maybe
either.
That makes sense.
Although I will say this, that then Wilbur Ross came out yesterday and said, well, that was our after-dinner entertainment that night.
Really?
At Mar-a-Lago when the and I'm like, really? Do you want to say that? Do you want to say that? This is good. You know, it is interesting to see people who are never in government. And part of being in government, especially in Washington, is you get to understand, because the military is everywhere there, right?
Yeah. You've
got the Pentagon, and you've got all the, you know, the officers and all the people who, you know, doing those jobs, and you get to be in contact with them. But if you're from other parts of the nation where you have no contact with the military, you don't really understand what it is. You don't have respect, the ultimate respect for the people that are, you know, doing those jobs. Yeah. You're like, you know, come on now, right?
So what time are you putting this guy on today?
4 o'clock, 4:10.
Very good.
So we will talk to him. Robert O'Neill, SEAL team operator. And he wrote a book right afterwards. Very controversial. We'll talk a little bit about that, too.
Good.
About all that. So thank you very much, John.